Tradition. 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 Last week we talked a little bit about Thanksgiving traditions, but tonight I wanted to at least address a specific tradition that was asked a few weeks ago, and that is the Jesse tree. And depending on time, we may move a little bit further. And part of the reason for doing the last verse of that particular hymn may relate to, if we get to talking about Advent and why Advent and what those four Sundays are, it may relate to that as well. So, what is a Jesse tree? A Jesse tree.
No.
She might have an opinion about that.
Do what?
She might have an opinion about
a
Jesse tree.
Well,
that's true. That's
true.
She likes Christmas trees.
That's true. Well, and it actually has something to do with trees, obviously, and it has something to do with the Christmas story. And from creation of the Christmas story. The question was asked the other week, why do people use a Jesse tree? When did it come about, and what's it mean? Well, actually, the Jesse trees can be traced back in the Christian church to somewhere around the 11th century in medieval times. Though some people say it was in the 12th century, around 1145, in stained glass windows preserved in the St. Denis Cathedral and the Chartres Cathedral. But the Jesse tree was meant to help clergy teach people about the Bible, illiterate people about the Bible, from creation through the Christmas story. Well, if it has something to do with the Christmas story and has something to do with history, then what Jesse are we talking about? Not Adkins. No, probably not Jesse Jackson either. King David's father, Jesse. It actually... Of course, I won't tell you though, I will not reveal who the question about the Jesse tree came from. But, yes, it's traced back to, with the Christmas story and Jesus' heritage, back to Jesse, the father of King David. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the girdle of his waist, and faithfulness the girdle of his loins. That's Isaiah chapter 11. That's verses 1 through 5. And if you continue on in the following verses, verses 6 and following, then it talks about, and obviously that is a description of Messiah, that the hope was for, the coming of Messiah. And if you continue in verses 6 and following, that's where you've got the wolf dwelling with the lamb and the leopard lying down with the kid and all those kinds of things in that kingdom under the Messiah. And so the Jesse tree was used in medieval times. In fact, some of the first Jesse trees were large carvings. Some were tapestries. Some were paintings on walls and buildings. I guess back then they didn't teach children not to draw and paint on a wall. And then later it goes into stained glass. Some of them, some Jesse trees, only go from the time of King David up to Jesus. Some Jesse trees were... had stories and symbols, or had symbols from creation and important events within history leading up to and pointing to the Christmas story and the coming of Jesus. The shoot and the branch, if you've got a stump and then you've got a shoot coming up, or you've got a branch coming out of it, that's a sign of what?
New growth.
New life. New growth, new life, out of something that seemed dead. And Messiah comes out of all of that. Now, at the time Isaiah composed this, it was probably for the coronation of King Hezekiah. There's a whole series here, several chapters, in particular, starting in chapter 9, of Isaiah, and we read some of these around the time of Christmas, looking toward Messiah. And Messiah was to be, in their minds, the ideal earthly king. It's not until Zedekiah dies at the Babylonian exile that that gets pushed off into the future hope. In chapter 9, we read, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nation. You've increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it, and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. And it continues on. And there's pretty good evidence that this was composed with the hope that Hezekiah was going to be the ideal king, because Ahaz had certainly not been. And now you've got this new king that comes, Hezekiah. And Hezekiah was a good king for a good bit of his reign. He made some mistakes later on. And so this whole idea of the throne of David, the Messiah would sit on the throne of David, would rule with justice and righteousness, and that this Messiah would come from the line of David, that is, from the line of Jesse, and there would be, the Spirit of God would be with him in certain ways, and there are different ways that Spirit. He has the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge, that's intimate knowledge of God, and the fear of the Lord, not afraid, but respect and reverence and all. And his delight shall be in that reverence, the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear, etc. And so the Jesse tree then looks back to that. And Christians saw Jesus as that new shoot, that new branch, that new life that comes out of Judaism, which to them seemed to be kind of on its last legs. And this is the hope of Judaism, where it seems like the dreams and the hopes were dashed, especially you've got the Babylonian exile and you've got the last of the kings dying out and all that going on. And well, does God even care? Is God powerful? That kind of thing. And then out of that, there's this transferred hope for Messiah. And then in Jesus, the Christians look back and they said, he's the one that fulfills this and judges with equity for the poor and the meek and all these kinds of things. And so they looked back and then saw Jesus as that new life and that new shoot, bringing really the Judeo-Christian tradition, bringing Judaism to full flower, blooming once again. We are part of a Judeo-Christian heritage, and without Christianity, Judaism never reaches its full potential. Of course, without Judaism, Christianity doesn't have those roots out of which to come. And since Jesus was a descendant of David, then Christians saw him as the new shoot. But unlike modern family trees, where oftentimes the most important person is the one at the base, right? At the roots. Unless you got one nose where it's just a trunk. But at the roots, Jesus is the one that is the focal point. Yes, Jesse is here, but Jesus is the pinnacle of the tree at the top. Not the foundation at the bottom, but the pinnacle at the top. Oftentimes when Jesse trees appear, they appear sometimes at grave sites and carvings and cemeteries and, as I said, in tapestries and paintings and stained glass windows. The figures and the symbols will all be facing toward the top, and generally toward the top right, where Jesus and either his name or the symbol for Jesus will be there. So the Jesse tree was used in particular to talk about Jesus and his heritage and how he fulfills those hopes and dreams, and he fulfills the promise that was made to Abraham and the Israelites. But sometimes it was also, there were things added to the Jesse tree, different figures and different symbols, either in paintings, or sometimes people will take a tree like and do things kind of like we do with chrismons. They'll make different kinds of symbols or shapes to put on the tree to remind them. Some people use Jesse trees, actually some Christians use Jesse trees kind of as the in lieu of an Advent calendar.
Did you bring one to show us?
No.
Is there,
I'm trying to picture it.
Is there an evergreen?
Here's a miniature of a drawing.
It's
a miniature of a painting with symbols. With symbols of right, it's like a family tree with.
It's like a telephone pole.
And let's see. Here's a carving. There's a carving of a Jesse tree. So it's not. Yeah, that's a carving of.
That's a carving
of a Jesse tree. And that's what it is. It's a family tree for Jesus and Judaism and Christianity, a family tree, a carving of the Jesse tree.
Does that top on that tree have anything to do with the reason we put stuff on top of our Christmas tree?
Well, in some ways, yes. Jerry just asked an interesting question. The top of the Jesse tree with Jesus and Mary at the top of the Jesse tree here and with the light, does that have anything to do with why we put things on the tops of our trees? Yes and no. Yes, because the star that was shining, we put stars, or the angel that was doing that, but Jesus himself is then the light of the world. And so all of those things do mix in with Jesse trees.
You see that more in like European Orthodox.
Yes. Yes. In Orthodox, in Roman Catholic, in Episcopal, and in Eastern Orthodox. In particular, Russian Orthodox. If you were to go to a Russian Orthodox church, you would find that, and you would find the carvings sometimes on doors, cathedral doors. There will be carvings of important persons or events within Christianity, but it was meant to help, as I said a while ago, it was meant to help the clergy teach stories from the Bible to the illiterate, because the majority of people in the Middle Ages couldn't read or write. And so, the passion plays that used to go around, they weren't just about the traveling passion plays. They were not just about the crucifixion and resurrection, though that was kind of the climactic scene and the resurrection at the end. But oftentimes they would start with depictions of the man and woman in the Garden of Eden and the serpent. Of course, they brought the apple out because it's probably a pomegranate or a fig. But in medieval times, and not the show, in medieval times, the apple was considered connected to passion. And so it must have been an apple. The medieval church gave us the apple as the fruit in the garden. The Bible only says it was a fruit. But there would be scenes, traveling minstrels that would go around and depict scenes from creation and the fall and other things up to the crucifixion and resurrection to help teach people about the Bible stories because they couldn't read them. In fact, the clergy were just about the only ones that could read. And so there were lots of different symbols that would be used in the Jesse trees, and there still are. For example, some of the symbols that would appear for folks who might be looking to uncover this whole heritage or lineage of the Bible to Jesus, not just from Jesse there. Now, folks will do it, but from creation to Jesus as the promise of God in creation, and Jesus at the Christmas story, would use it as an Advent calendar. And so each day there would be a different symbol either placed on the tree or drawn or pointed to if it was a carving or whatever to tell the story. Some of the symbols, not all, but some of the symbols that often have been used for creation, and we'll give 25 symbols here. For creation, there would be a carving or a painting of the earth. That God cared enough to where God created in beginning and created this earth for us and put us in this earth. Adam and Eve would be depicted not by people, but there would be in the carving or in the painting, there would be a small tree with an apple hanging on it. You know, the first humans, Adam and Eve, and the fall in the garden, which then makes the Christmas story and what's beyond all that much more important. Another important event that teaches about God's care and God's promises and God's covenant, Noah and the flood. And no, they didn't put a boat. Typical symbol was a rainbow that would either be painted in there or placed on the tree or carved. God makes the promise to Abraham. Abraham picks up and moves. If you move to this land, then I'll give it to you and all your descendants and to your offspring. And, of course, they interpreted offspring. The church later interpreted offspring as not Isaac, but Jesus, who would be that offspring out there, would be a tent because he was a wandering Aramean. Isaac, the promise to keep the covenant going through Isaac, what kind of symbol would you think that might go with Isaac? Not a knife, but something really... No, something really bad. A ram. Because God provided the ram as a sacrifice and he kept the covenant going and showed God, and showed Abraham and Isaac how much he cared. The patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, a symbol for Jacob. What do you think of other than his being deceptive and fathering a whole little village between those four wives? What do you think of with Jacob?
That's about it. He was a deceiver.
Jacob's ladder. There'd be a ladder placed in there. Jacob's sometimes with figures, angelic figures on it, because he saw the angels going up and down the ladder. God keeping the promise of that covenant alive. The next important individual keeping that covenant going kept them alive in Egypt. Who would that be and what might the symbol be, even though I've said that Joseph, and what might the symbol for Joseph be, even though I've said it was, the Bible says it only had long sleeves. There would be a multicolored coat or robe, even though the Bible never says that it was multicolored, it says it had long sleeves.
Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah, Dolly Parton. In a lot of royalty and royal robes had multiple colors on theirs, and they said, okay, well, Joseph was royalty and this kind of thing. No, and he was the favorite, but the Bible doesn't say anything about multicolor. But royalty typically had, you know, they wore vibrant, even the pharaohs, their outfits were more vibrant than anybody else. Yeah, as Sally would. Ed with his vibrant colors.
Yeah. Ed has many coats of colors.
He does. The next important, really important figure in that whole history of God keeping the covenant and keeping the promises and keeping the people alive would be Moshe, Moses. The word is Moshe, which means to draw out, but Moses. And the sign for Moses?
A basket?
No, that comes with the Decalogue. Well, that's for the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are another symbol with the stone tablets. But how does God? When does God communicate with Moses and tell him we're going to keep this burning bush? The symbol would be a burning bush, and that allowed the clergy to talk about Moses and God speaking to Moses and promising to rescue the people at the burning bush. After the Ten Commandments, the two stone tablets, they went down really hard. boom, boom. In fact, they broke. No. Is that the care of the people then is passed on to Joshua, and Joshua helps them to conquer the land first by conquering Jericho. And how did they conquer Jericho? They marched around, they screamed and hollered, and they blew what? Shofars, ram's horn trumpet. Ram's horns, trumpets. Interestingly enough, in the middle of all of this, you got Ruth, and she wasn't even a baby. No, you got Ruth, and the gathering and the gleaning of the corn. You know, Ruth is one of those that's in the lineage of Jesus. And you know, Ruth would be symbolized with a sheaf of corn. Then you got the biggie, David, King David. What does Israel use to represent King David? Six-pointed star. Which comes in very in a key place in the story of Jesus, because at the Christmas story, you've got the star that's shown in the night. Then you've got Solomon. Solomon, you could say wise and all those kinds of things, but what was Solomon able to do that brought God, brought the worship of God, centered the worship of God for the people that David couldn't? There would be a picture of the temple, a carving or a drawing of the temple. Not elaborate, but just to let, so they could talk about God continuing there with Solomon, and God's presence with the people is solidified with the building of the temple in that place. Who was it that was, that announced that there would be a Messiah to come, and who was it that was supposed to come back and announce that the Messiah was here? Which prophet? Elijah. Elijah, who was carried from earth in a fiery chariot. And so either a fiery chariot or a bonfire with a chariot beside it would be the symbol, once again, reminded that God didn't forget. God promised through Elijah, and Elijah's coming back.
How many generations are we going to by now?
A bunch.
Oh,
let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, we're at a dozen. And then we come to the Jesse prophecy. And the Jesse prophecy would be symbolized, just like right here, a stump with a branch coming out of it. And that branch then points to Jesus. And actually, when it comes to that stump and the branch, of course, the symbol for Jesus is at the top. And in some of the stained glass is at the top right, so guess which way that branch is pointing? Up to the right, to draw your attention there. Then you've got God continuing, not just for the Jews, but even the enemies of the Jews. Lo and behold, in many Jesse trees, Jonah is thrown in there. And what would be the symbol for Jonah, do you think?
Big fish.
Yeah, a big fish. A big fish. Then you've got John the Baptist. John the Baptist, well, baptizing, but interestingly enough, and the symbol for John the Baptist in early Christian art is a scallop shell. A scallop shell. And part of the reason for that, there has been a question, as the church developed, there was a question about mode of baptism. You know, and do you dunk them? Do you sprinkle them? Do you pour over their heads? And he's there on the Jordan River, coming out of the Sea of Galilee, this kind of thing, between there and the Dead Sea. And so the symbol for him was a scallop shell as he would scoop up water to pour. Mary. Could have been anything. And if you look at I thought it was interesting, the movie Jesus of Nazareth, which was one of the most popular ones and was on for several hours when it was first made. Franco Zeffirelli did it. Jesus comes and kneels down, and John takes a double scoop full of water and puts it over his head. That actually comes out of, that idea comes out of how the church was developing and with a didache and those kinds of things. Mary is there, and Mary is typically or oftentimes shown not as Madonna and child, although in the carving you do have the Madonna and child at the top. Typically, Elizabeth is in here, and Mary's cousin Elizabeth is holding a child that is John the Baptist. But Mary is often, and she's not flower. She's symbolized by a white lily. She is symbolized by a flower, but not white lily flower. purity. Yes, the white lily. And the lily, she bears the lily of the valley. Jesus. Zechariah in this heritage. Zechariah announcing that his son, John, is the forerunner for Messiah. Zechariah is a scribe. Zechariah, a tablet. A pencil and a tablet, or a writing utensil and a tablet, because what was he told when he laughed at the angel and said, "Oh, my wife's beyond childbearing years? Yeah, you can't talk." So he'd have to write down. And when John is actually named, Elizabeth speaks up and says, "His name shall be John." And they turn and look at her and they look at him, and he writes down, "His name shall be John." And then his mouth is opened and he sings a song. Joseph. Joseph's a carpenter. If I had a... Joseph symbolized by a hammer in the Jesse tree. The shepherds. Sheep. And typically, fluffy sheep. Because Passover is in there, and there's a lamb as well. You got Decalogue, but you also got Passover, and there's a lamb. But this is a fluffy sheep. The Magi. Well, I didn't smoke. Although they come from afar. No. Typically, the Magi were either a gold star, or there would be three gold crowns, or there would be three gifts, boxes, gold boxes for gifts in the Jesse tree. And then finally, the coming of Jesus. The birth of Jesus was symbolized by a manger with a baby. A baby in the manger. And so they could pick any part or could go all the way through. And when it was used as an Advent, kind of like instead of an Advent calendar, each day in that period leading up to it, the clergy could talk about, or if you had one in your home, a painting or whatever, you could talk about those things and trace the whole, the love and the care of God from creation all the way through sending Jesus. And so the Jesse tree, and some people will take, kind of how people decorate, these days they'll take and they'll set up a little tree and they'll hang Easter eggs on them. Or at Halloween, they'll hang little pumpkins or ghosts or whatever. Some people will take something like that, just a bare tree, and then will make their own. And part of it, some folks will do, not real formal, but to get their families involved, some folks will have their children to help make the different symbols and put them on the tree. Each day, there's a different symbol placed on the tree. So kind of like we do with the chrismons, once again. The chrismons have particular meaning and are made. So that's kind of the Jesse tree, and it started in the Middle Ages around the time for when people were so illiterate and they needed these pictures, these images, and those kinds of things to help teach the stories. Well, as we know Christmas trees, legend says that Martin Luther was the first one to bring an evergreen in. And he brought it into his home, and he put candles on it. Legend says he was out walking in the forest and the fields in Germany in December, and what do you find? Lots of snow and the stars and that kind of thing. And he was so impressed that one of the legends is that he came upon an evergreen tree, and he was admiring it, admiring the snow on the branches and the way the moon was shining off the snow, and he looked up, and one of the legends said it was a star, one said the North Star was positioned right at the top of that tree. And so he brought that tree in, an evergreen, ever-living, evergreen, almost sounds like something that you might find in a Hang of the Green service, ever-living, evergreen, that kind of a symbol of eternity and everlasting life. So legend says he brought that home, shook off the snow, brought it in the house, put candles on the branches. It didn't catch on fire, but to tell his children about all of that. And then later, different things get added. And, of course, St. Nicholas morphs into Santa Claus. Nicholas, who would leave things for people, leave money and pay the dowries for... One man caught him paying the dowry for his daughter, throwing it up, and it came down the chimney. Those kinds of things. Anything else on that? Well, quickly, we're about to approach Advent, and 4 Sundays in Advent, right? Four weeks before Christmas. Comes from the Latin Adventus, which means coming, which actually comes out of the Greek perousia or parousia, which means coming, which is linked to the second coming of Jesus. And actually, I said, soon he's coming back to welcome me far beyond the starry sky. While we look at Advent particularly to remember the coming of Jesus that first time, initially, Advent was not looking to... They didn't talk about the Christmas story and the baby in the manger. They were looking to what? The future, the second coming. And the church was waiting for that Advent to occur. Now, as time passes, then Advent gets to looking and remembering the coming of Jesus the first time. And in some church traditions, the first 2 Sundays of Advent actually look back to the coming of Jesus, and the last 2 Sundays focus on the hope for the future coming. He came once, and he promised to come back again, and so he does so. Now, Advent, as a formal remembrance and celebration, probably developed somewhere in the 4th or 5th centuries in Gaul, scholars differ as to whether they think it was in Gaul or in Spain. Gaul of them. Whether it was in Gaul or in Spain. And actually, in the early church, before medieval times, in the early church, Christians typically, after those first decades, Christians were baptized at Easter. And so you had a period of preparation prior to that baptism. You look forward to Easter Sunday when you were baptized. As the church developed later on, in some places in Gaul and other places, new Christians were baptized at Epiphany in January, when the Magi make their final trek and get there. Epiphany was celebrated January the 6th. That's where we get 12 days of Christmas. And so that's when new converts were baptized. So the 40 days prior to that, like what developed with Lent, the 40 days prior to that was to be a time, not a time of celebration, not a time of hanging the evergreens and drinking the eggnog and having all kinds of celebrations. Actually, it was a time of preparation for those Christians. There was supposed to be 40 days of penance, prayer, and fasting to prepare themselves for baptism. We may do a lot of praying, but we sure don't do a lot of fasting during that time now, do we? No. Or tonight. It was... Yes. Where there are 2 or 3 Baptists gathered, a chicken must die. I saw that recently. And actually... Early on, there was, at Epiphany, there was a celebration of the Magi's visit, the baptism, because they're being baptized, of Jesus in the Jordan River, the miracle at Cana was remembered, and then his crucifixion and resurrection, actually all tied into those 4 Sundays, those 4 weeks. But during the season of preparation, they spent 40 days in penance, prayer, and fasting to prepare for the baptism of the new Christians. And it wasn't just the new Christians. It was the folks in the church that fasted and prayed and did penance. However, by the 6th century, the Roman Catholic Church as it was developing, by the 6th century, Advent was tied to the coming of Christ, but even there, it wasn't focused on the birth, it was focused on the second coming. The teaching was that just as Israel waited for that first coming and the world was not what it should be, so the church now waits in anticipation, because the world is not what it should be, the church waits in anticipation of His coming again. So Advent originally, as we understand it, had nothing to do with the birth stories. It had everything to do with the hope, just as Israel hoped for Messiah and waited and waited and Messiah came, so now our hope is for Messiah to come again. And though in those early periods, the preaching that went on didn't deal with the Christmas story. It dealt with things like out of 1 Thessalonians when with the trumpets called and the cry of the archangel, and the dead in Christ will rise first, and then we will be with Him, and those kinds of things. But what's really interesting, and I've noticed the last couple of years in particular, the Advent bulletins and the Advent wreaths and those kinds of things don't always talk about hope, peace, joy, and love. That's tradition, hope, peace, joy, and love. But some of them have been substituting other things. The prophecy candle. That's the first candle. Hope, the prophecy candle. Some of the readings, once again, Isaiah chapter 11, or Romans chapter 15. Verses 12 and 13. And further, Isaiah says, "The root of Jesse shall come, he who rises to rule the Gentiles. In him shall the Gentiles hope. Therefore may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope." The prophecy from Isaiah of Jesse and Jesse's lineage, and he comes for the nations, not just the Jews. The second candle in the last few years, some people have been calling it the Bethlehem candle, focusing on God coming, and God, for God so loved the world that He gave His only Son. But God coming in Jesus is a time of preparation. The third, which is joy, is also called the shepherd's candle. Glory to God in the highest. The shepherds come with great joy, and they return with exceeding joy, telling everyone. Love is sometimes called the angel or the angelic candle. From Luke chapter 2, when the angel makes the pronouncement as well. And then, of course, the fifth candle, always the white candle, is the Christ candle. So the four Sundays of Advent, where we typically look forward to, and I think rightly so, that first coming to remind us that it wasn't just something that was haphazard and happenstance, hasn't always been tied to the Christmas story. In its earliest days, it was tied to baptism and to looking for the second coming and the hope for the second coming. In fact, there were actually some folks in those early centuries that fully believed that okay, Jesus came, and we celebrate that at Christmas time, but the second coming would be at Epiphany. Just as the Magi followed the star and found the babe in his first coming, so the second coming would also happen at Epiphany in January.
We don't observe Epiphany.
No, we don't. High church traditions do. Folks who do observe Epiphany typically leave the Christmas tree up until then.
Yeah, I mean, for some reason, in my family, it has to be down by New Year's Day. But that's just when Epiphany starts. If you do the 12 days of Christmas, it starts on Christmas.
Mm-hmm. And goes to January 6th.
And it goes to January 6th. So a lot of people take their tree down January 6th.
Yeah, they do. And I know folks in some traditions. I've got some friends that are Lutheran, and they don't put their tree up until Christmas Eve and take it down at Epiphany.
A lot of other people, that's when they put theirs up. Let me ask you another question on that. One of my church God, they celebrate, she says Christmas, God, we say December 25th, born in the summertime, June, I think is when they celebrate. What's the tie in that way? Why?
December is the rainy season. Self-respecting shepherds wouldn't be out watching the sheep in a rainy season anyway. Although I've had people say, oh, well, they took them inside a cave while it rained and then they let them out when it wasn't. But December the 25th was also, in the Roman Empire, was the celebration for Saturnalis. And everyone had a day off. And Christians got to the point where, you know, they were off and they began, as time developed, they began thinking, well, they would celebrate and make a statement. Christians would celebrate. There was something more important than Saturnalis. There was the birth of the Son of God. And so December the 25th was chosen for that. And that's near the winter solstice. The Orthodox Church has some different. Typically, the Orthodox Church celebrates Easter at a different time. Although in 2017, Orthodox Easter will be at the same time that, sometimes the day is different. The date is different. Now, as far as the other, some scholars say Jesus was born in the spring. Just like Passover's in the spring. Easter's in the spring. There are some who, in Church of God, there's some Church of Gods who, their claim is Jesus was born in the summer. And June would be the time of the vernal equinox. Once again, tied to the longest daylight of the year. Part of the thing with winter, being near the winter solstice is, as time has gotten shorter, there's more and more darkness in the world, and Jesus comes and brings light as well. I sure hope that's in something that won't break. but there are folks who also, some scholars argue that it was before the rainy season, probably in September-ish. But we really don't know because they didn't record it on a calendar.
They don't know.
Yeah. And you know, and they
would it make a difference if we did know? No,
it really wouldn't. I don't think it's
just like the Sabbath. We don't celebrate the true Sabbath. Which
is Sabbath is the seventh day of the week. Yeah.
Well, would not a clear night start
through the night? And the song "In the Bleak Midwinter." I like that song, but at that Christmas song. But it really doesn't depict what probably the weather was like. You know, I mean, although Mary found, and we found a sign the other day, she bought her little box, she bought it, and it says, just pretend that the snow is really white sand and the winter wind is tropical breezes. Sometimes I don't think that works. But there would be some people that would so hone in on that if we knew. It would almost be like, I've said, we do not have any original autographs, any original writings of anything in the Bible. And if they exist anywhere, I'm not so sure I'd want God to let us find them. Because we would do with them the same thing we do with the Shroud of Turin and the Bones of the Saints and all those other things. And we would display them in such a way. Our human nature would display them in such a way that it would actually, I think, diminish the respect and the reverence.
When I think about Christmas, and if I think about what happened, and if I wrote down every day of the season the things that were getting the most attention, so little of it would even have to do with the birth.
Oh, I know.
I mean, most of the traditions we celebrate as a culture have absolutely nothing to do.
Christmas celebration has been co-opted by the culture and society. And even though, St. Nicholas really was a good person and doing that for the right reasons to help, he turned into the jolly fat man that, you know, that kind of thing. But I think of the spirit of Christmas, and that's something that the boys, you might want to stop up your ears. That's something when the boys found out. it was a thing where, if you stop believing in the spirit of it, that's to think. And the spirit of St. Nicholas, and which was prompted by the spirit of Christ that was guiding what St. Nicholas did. And he wasn't a saint until later, but Nicholas. Of course, you've got Sinterklaas and other places. Babbo Natale. Yeah. Babbo Natale. Toko Gigio. Sorry. The Santa Claus.
Well, I asked the question because I knew I grew up with my cousins. No, it's different. They said, no, Jesus wasn't born. You know, no, it's different. Back and forth for it. That's just one thing.
Do they celebrate Christmas in December?
No, they do not.
They do not.
They're not.
You know, and as far as the year, yeah, our calendar's off. You know, I mean, Dionysius Exiguus in the 6th century, that Scythian monk that decided to change the calendar from AUC, Ab Urbe Condita, which took the founding of Rome as a pivotal event in history. And he decided the birth of the Son of God was more important, so he goes tracing all these things back, changes the calendar. All that kind of stuff, but the year zero, this is when Jesus was born. Everything's A.D. here, Anno Domini, year of the Lord, everything before Christ here. And 2 centuries later, somebody figured it out when they got to looking at the calendars. If you went by his calendar and by the calendar we do, Herod the Great died in 4 B.C. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. If you look, if you put the calendars together, Herod, by that calendar, Herod died in 4 B.C., so Herod the Great. So wait a minute. That doesn't... But they figured by that time, instead of going and changing all the dates on everything, if we updated the calendar, instead of 2016, we'd be coming to the close of at least 2020.
Thank you.
So Jesus was born in 4 B.C. I thought he was born in 4 A.D.
No.
Are you sure of that?
Yeah.
I said, are you sure of that?
Yeah. But, yeah. But the important thing is that he was born and he lived as he did and died and was raised. So I said, we're just going to do this briefly, and then took off on Advent. Next thing you know, it's 3 minutes till 7. But, well, I mean, Ed and Sarah have been here an extra 10 minutes.
Yeah. I turn the lights on.
Well, thank you all. God bless you. Go in peace.